everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm Jason Shulman. We've got a great show for you today. My guest is Robert Holub, who teaches at Ohio State University and is the former chancellor of UMass Amherst. Here to talk about his new book, Nietzsche's Jewish Problem, Between Anti-Semitism and Anti-Judaism, published this year by Princeton University Press. Bob, welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. So, Bob, maybe you could start by telling us a bit about who Friedrich Nietzsche was. He lived in the second half of the 19th century, is that right?
That's right. He was a German philosopher, born in 1844, died in 1900, very well known and very influential, especially in the 20th century, not so influential during his own time when he had problems selling his own books. But subsequently, after his after he went insane and at the end of 1888, and then when he died in 1900, he became a very famous philosopher.
What's going on in Germany at the time? What major conversations is Nietzsche participating in?
Well, it's my contention that he was participating in a lot of major conversations. Most observers of Nietzsche and most commentators on Nietzsche tend to ignore the connections that he had with his time, but he was very much involved with issues of his day, the German question, which became a big question because Germany was not a unified nation until 1870, and Nietzsche was involved with that, both positively and negatively, on the side of unification and against unification. He was involved with issues of women's liberation, which came up at that time. The first big emancipation movement grew in the 1870s and the 1880s. He was involved, of course, also with questions of colonialism, which Germany was a little behind in acquiring colonies, but there was a colonialist movement, and Germany eventually acquired colonies in 1884. He was involved in the scientific movements of his time, Darwinism and evolution, as well as eugenics, and things like thermodynamics were also very influential for him, those scientific discoveries of the 19th century. And one of them, of course, was the Jewish question, which was a pressing question of his time and was discussed by many people in Germany and in Europe.
So 20 years ago, you wrote an article called Nietzsche and the Jewish Question. Then you sort of put the matter aside and came back to it, right, resulting in this book. What attracted you to this question about Nietzsche and the Jews?
Well, it was actually just one of the many questions that I was examining. As I said, well, when I first started to study Nietzsche in the 1990s, I recognized that most commentators did not consider him as embedded in his time. They didn't contextualize his work, and if they contextualized anything, they made him part of a kind of a general philosophical movement. When I looked at Nietzsche's library, for example, I saw that he had very few works by the great philosophers, the philosophers in the German tradition or the European tradition, nothing by Hegel or Leibniz, very little by Immanuel Kant, but he had many books from his time. So I began to investigate that and saw that he was really in a debate with various things about various things that were going on in the 19th century. And I decided to write a book in which I would deal with Nietzsche as in dialogue with the 19th century in a certain way. And so one of the questions that I wanted to deal with was the Jewish question, and that was the question that I dealt with in that article to which you just referred in 1995. Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, it depends on how you're looking at it, I moved into academic, into academic administration shortly after that. Became a dean at Berkeley, where I was for my first 27 years as a faculty member, became a dean there, and then was the provost at the University of Tennessee, and then the chancellor at UMass Amherst. And in those positions, I had very little time to continue my research. When I arrived at Ohio State as a professor in 2012, I decided to go back to that original book that I was writing, and had to do a lot of research because a lot of people had written a lot of things in the interim. And when I got to the chapter that I was writing on Nietzsche and the Jewish question, which was the title of the article and the chapter, I found that there was so much material that I really didn't do it justice in just expanding on what I'd written in 1995. And so I decided to write a book on it. And that's how the book came into being.
I found it very sort of honest and refreshing that you mentioned at the beginning of the book, basically, not that that article was wrong, but that it could be more precise. And that's what you wanted to do. You wanted to bring it up to date and make things a little bit more precise. How did it feel to come back to that material after such a long time?
Well, it was a little bit strange. There were many things that were written in the interim, some of them good, some of them not so good. But what I discovered was that in going back into the material and looking at it in more detail, and I hadn't done a good enough job in 1995, that is, I hadn't read everything that I could read about Nietzsche. I didn't understand as much as I should have understood about what antisemitism represented in the 19th century. I didn't know as much as I should have about Nietzsche's relationship to his sister and what his sister had done or not done with regard to his reputation as an anti-Semite. I hadn't looked at all of the early lectures in as much detail as I should have, and I hadn't considered closely enough, I think, his relationship to Richard Wagner and Richard Wagner's wife, Cosima, as a really important moment in Nietzsche's anti-Jewish thought. So there were things that were right in that article. I don't think it was wrong, but it wasn't really refined enough, and it didn't resolve issues that should have been resolved and that I tried to resolve now in this book.
A lot has been written about this question about Nietzsche and anti-Semitism. Do you have a sense of why people are so fascinated by it? And why does it matter if he was anti-Semitic? Does it impact his standing as sort of in the pantheon of philosophers?
Well, let me answer the first part of that first, and that is that I think it's important because it was an issue that most intellectuals in Germany faced. And of course, without the Holocaust, it probably wouldn't be quite as pressing an issue. But because of the Holocaust, because Nietzsche was used by National Socialism as one of its precursors, because Nietzsche was seen outside of Germany as someone who had contributed to a certain militaristic stance and toward a certain racist stance, therefore it becomes an important question for us as to how he really reacted toward Jews and Judaism in his time. Unfortunately, most of the material that has been written on this has looked at it through the lens of the Holocaust and has not seen what the actual relations were that Nietzsche was entering into in the 19th century. That is, what he was reacting against and what he was discussing, really, in his writings when he mentioned Jews in the 19th century. So that there's an entire group of people who excuse his anti-Jewish thought because he makes various remarks against anti-Semitism. And he was against anti-Semitism. But we have to understand what anti-Semitism represented for him. It doesn't represent what it represents for us. We think of anti-Semitism as anti-Judaism or equated with anti-Judaism. But anti-Semitism for Nietzsche in the 1880s, when the anti-Semitic movement was just beginning in Germany and then spread to other countries in Europe, that anti-Semitic movement was a specific political movement to which Nietzsche had to react because he had personal relationships with it because of his publisher and because of his sister. And so there were things that he was reacting against that had not as much to do with his feelings about Jews as it did about a specific political movement of his time. And so his anti-Semitism, which people took after the war in many cases to be the token of his philo-Semitism, let's say, was mistaken. That is, his opposition to anti-Semitism doesn't tell us everything we need to know about his relationship to Jews and Judaism. And there remained in his thought a kind of an anti-Jewish or Judeo-phobic underpinning throughout his conscious lifetime. So that's one of the things that I tried to clear up in the book. Now, why it's important for us I think it's important because when you're looking at a philosopher, and especially one who's very critical of many philosophical tenets and of many moral tenets, I think you have to look and see how he reflected upon his own prejudices. And here is a case, and we could also expand that to his views of women, but here is a case where Nietzsche was not very good at reflecting, I think, upon his own prejudices and rising above them and seeing that he harbored some of the tradition in Germany, some of the anti-Jewish tradition while he was writing. So that does give us pause, or does give me a little bit of pause when I look at his writings, because he was not quite as critical and not quite as self-overcoming as he sometimes portrays himself.
Right. Just to go back to the first part of that question. So, you know, the thinking of anti-Semitism as a political movement grounded in the late 19th century is really sort of the key to understanding the difference between that and what we think of as just regular anti-Semitism today. How did you sort of come up with the distinction between anti-Semitism and Judeophobia, which is just sort of more of a negative bias, but not doesn't have any sort of political stake?
Well, I use that as a kind of heuristic map for the book, because I couldn't use anti-Semitic because I wanted to use that in the very specific sense of referring to these movements in the 1880s. Now, anti-Semitism as a word doesn't even come into existence until around 1880. We're not quite sure who used the word first, but it arose in that anti-Jewish context of the early 1880s. And so you're dealing with something fairly specific when you're dealing with anti-Semitism if you're living in 1880. And a lot of the individuals who lived at that time didn't think it was the right word, including Nietzsche. Nietzsche says in his notebooks, he writes about miso-juden, that is miso, the prefix for hatred of, and juden for Jews. This is what he calls the anti-Semites, because that's a more correct formulation. They weren't against Semites, that is all the Semites, they were against just the Jews. And so anti-Semitic is really the wrong word for anti-Jewish, and people recognize that. The National Socialists recognized that and discouraged the use of that word. And people in Nietzsche's time also were taken aback by that word, because they were against the Jews and not necessarily against all Semites. So what attracted me to it was the wrong use of this word. And so I looked at where it came from and what was going on and why it was being used. And then I saw that Nietzsche was reacting against something quite different than I had originally thought. That is, he wasn't someone who turned against anti-Semitism because he was didn't hold any prejudices against Jews, or didn't adhere to some cliches about the Jewish people and what Jews represented in Europe. He did it because he was against this specific movement, which was a much cruder movement that suggested solutions that Nietzsche felt were extreme and unworkable and unrealistic in the time. And so that I had to make then a distinction between anti-Semitic thought as it existed in Nietzsche's time and Judeophobic thought or anti-Jewish thought, which is something a little bit different.
So during his lifetime, anti-Semites didn't really consider him an ally, which is kind of a favorable point for your argument. It's only after his death that his writing gets picked up and appropriated. Can you tell us a little bit about how groups co-opted him for sort of right-wing ends? And tell us about his sister and the publication of his work.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing is that at first, the anti-Semites did think he belonged to them. Before he started to write against anti-Semitism, they considered him to be an ally. And the reason they did was because he came out of the Wagner Circle. The Wagner Circle, Richard Wagner, had written very many things against Jews. So they considered him to be part of the extended Wagner Circle and thought he was a natural ally. Only when he started then to write against anti-Semitism did they see that he wasn't that much of an ally. And so there was conflict between him and the and many anti-Semitic groups in the late 1880s. But gradually, the right wing, as you got into the 20th century, began to adopt Nietzsche because of his kind of, let's say, oppositional stance toward the status quo. And we have to remember that the right-wing movement in the early part of the 20th century was not a conservative movement. It was opposed to the status quo. Even the National Socialist movement considered itself a movement rather than a party almost. So that we're dealing with people who like this kind of oppositional character in Nietzsche. And eventually, he was forgiven for his remarks against anti-Semitism, forgiven for his remarks against the German nation, which are the two pillars of the kind of National Socialist movement, anti-Semitism and ultra-nationalism. He was forgiven for those by saying, well, in his time, he had good reason to oppose the anti-Semites of his time, and he had good reason to oppose the Bismarckian nationalism of that time. But if he were living in our time, the speculation was, then he would be on our side, which, of course, is a kind of a an argument that's impossible to refute and impossible to prove. But that's how he gradually got integrated into the right-wing movement. He made many very positive remarks about war and the warrior, some of which people see as metaphorical, but were taken quite literally. So he became popular during World War One. I would say, as the first big conservative or right-wing appropriation of Nietzsche. And then throughout the Weimar Republic, he was adopted by leftists as well as the right wing. He had appeal to both of them because of this kind of oppositional status. And only when you get into the Third Reich after Hitler comes to power in 1933, as he looked upon throughout the German academic world, although there was some controversy there as well, he was looked upon as a precursor of National Socialism because of very influential Nazis picked him up as this kind of a precursor. In the external world, that is the world external to Germany, he was also seen as someone who had contributed to a kind of bellicose German profile, and therefore was also seen as someone who was in line with National Socialism. So that was how he became associated with them. After the war, there was an attempt in Germany by various individuals and in the United States by Walter Kaufmann mostly to exonerate Nietzsche in some way. And in this exoneration, they looked for someone to blame. And the person who got blamed for his anti-Semitism and for his ultra-nationalism was his sister Elizabeth, who herself had known Hitler and was in charge of the Nietzsche archives for many years. So she was someone who was a natural person to blame for putting Nietzsche into this National Socialist camp. This, I feel, has been very unfair to Elizabeth, who wasn't a very nice person and was kind of on the conservative right wing of the Weimar Republic, but was never herself really someone who claimed that Nietzsche was anti-Semitic. That is, if you read what she wrote about Nietzsche, she always claimed that he wasn't an anti-Semite, that he wasn't anti-Jewish, that Wagner was the anti-Semite and Nietzsche wasn't. And she herself, who had married one of the chief agitators of the anti-Semitic movement, a man named Bernard Förster, and had moved with him to Paraguay to found a kind of a pure Aryan colony in Nueva Germania, she herself broke away from her anti-Semitism by the 1890s and said publicly that she had no reason to oppose the Jews at all. So that blaming her was an easy thing after the war in order to exonerate Nietzsche from any guilt with regard to anti-Semitism, but it just wasn't true. It just wasn't the right story. And circumstantial evidence leads people to blame Elizabeth for this, because she was married to an anti-Semite, because she knew Hitler, because Hitler came to the Nietzsche archives and was very favorably was photographed with Elizabeth, because Hitler also attended Elizabeth's funeral when she died in 1935. So all of this circumstantial evidence makes it appear that Elizabeth would have been someone who could have made Nietzsche into an anti-Semite, but she didn't. The one thing that she did do is she falsified some of his works. So she did tinker with his letters and a little bit with the texts that we have. But if you look at what she did, there is nothing in what she did that makes Nietzsche more anti-Jewish than he was. There is nothing that excises the remarks against anti-Semitism, which she includes in her version of his letters. There's nothing she does in his works that really makes him into an anti-Semite or an ultra-nationalist. So I think that people have taken this up very quickly, and Elizabeth is still looked upon as the evil person who pushed Nietzsche into this camp. But if you look at the evidence soberly, you'll see that this just wasn't true.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about Wagner. You mentioned him a couple of times. Why is he so central to Nietzsche? And a larger question, I guess, is failure to condemn something the same as approving it?
Well, that second question is a harder one to answer, but I can talk a little bit about the relationship of Nietzsche and Wagner. Nietzsche met Wagner in 1868. Nietzsche at that time was a student in Leipzig, so he hadn't even gotten his PhD. He didn't have a position as a professor. Wagner was already a well-known composer throughout Europe. He was a European celebrity at that time. The relationship that we sometimes imagine between the two is one of equals, but they weren't equal at all. Wagner was actually from Nietzsche's father's generation, not from Nietzsche's generation. And if you know something about Wagner, then you know that he had an entire entourage of people, and Nietzsche more or less became part of his entourage, not his intellectual equal. As so that when Nietzsche later on in 1888, when he writes Nietzsche contra Wagner as a text, that is trying to put them on the same plane, but they were never on the same plane in terms of their European fame or their fame in Germany. So Nietzsche was very impressed by Wagner, became part of his entourage, and adopted most of his ideology in the late 1860s and the early 1870s. And part of Wagner's ideology was, frankly, anti-Jewish, very anti-Jewish. He wrote Judaism and Music. That was a text that he'd written much earlier, but he republished this in 1869. And there was a tremendous response. This was when Nietzsche knew Wagner very well. And Nietzsche was visiting his house in Triebschen, which was not very far from Basel. And so he would go there for Christmas and go there for holidays. And he was close with the Wagners and with Wagner's wife, Cosima. Judaism and Music had a tremendous impact, because there was a great controversy about it, and Jews were not very happy about it. There was some disruption of performances of Wagner. Nietzsche learned all about these things while he was involved with Wagner, and he didn't object to this. What Nietzsche did was he tried to fit in with Wagnerian ideology. So in one of the studies that he wrote, one of the early lectures that he delivered, which would eventually go into his first major non-philological work, which was The Birth of Tragedy, he wrote about Socratism and says Socratism, which is a negative for Nietzsche, Socratism is this rationalistic movement in Greece that destroys Greek tragedy. He wrote, Socratism in the modern world is the Jewish press. Well, he sent the copy of this lecture to the Wagners, and the Wagners were very upset about this. They're upset not because they didn't agree with this, but because they felt that Nietzsche would ruin his career and his reputation, endanger his position and his standing with making remarks like this, which were, of course, remarks that Wagner had already made in various contexts. But Wagner was much better able to absorb the criticism. So they advised Nietzsche, as far as we can tell from the correspondence, not to do this. Cosima writes to him and says, I agree with everything you're saying, but don't say this so directly. When it's time, we'll all come out and we'll make these kinds of statements, but this isn't the right thing to do. So from then on, during the Wagnerian period of Nietzsche's writings up until the mid-1870s, Nietzsche never mentions the Jews or Judaism again in that kind of a context. All of the references that he has to Jews and Judaism while he's a Wagnerian acolyte are references that are somewhat hidden. Some of them are pretty obvious. He'll talk about nomadic moneylenders, for example. There's nobody living in the 1870s who wouldn't have identified that phrase, nomadic moneylenders, with Jews. But Nietzsche refrained from mentioning Jews in that kind of a negative cultural light, not mentioning them directly, during that period in the early 1870s. And at the same time, he did try to adhere to this anti-Jewish Wagnerian ideology and did so, I think, in various works. And I try to show that in the book as well. Now, the second question that you ask, you'll have to repeat and tell me what kind of a context you're talking about.
Well, it seemed that, Nietzsche was not disapproving of what Wagner was saying, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he was approving.
To some extent, Nietzsche was not as ideologically prone as Wagner was, but and especially in his earliest work, the Birth of Tragedy, Nietzsche would not make these direct marks about Jews, but I think that that's explained by the Wagner's putting a prohibition on it. But if you do look at his writings, you'll see that what could be called the anti-Semitic cultural code of the early 1870s, something that Wagnerians would have recognized as anti-Jewish, that has a prominent place in Nietzsche's writings, not only in The Birth of Tragedy, where you find it more or less under this kind of a Greek veneer or this veneer of dealing with ancient Greece, but also and more prominently in the Four Untimely Meditations that he writes, where he did try to enter into cultural criticism. Anti-Jewish thought was never a major kind of a major concern of Nietzsche's. That is, Nietzsche did not share with Wagner the kind of paranoia about Jews in culture and Jews in music, although he did feel, and at many points, that Jews were the natural opposition to the greatness of the Wagnerian Renaissance that he desired so much. And if you look at the reception of The Birth of Tragedy, just for an example, Nietzsche and his friends were upset at the reaction against The Birth of Tragedy and ascribed it to a conspiracy of Berlin Jews, which was a little bit absurd because the person who wrote the main criticism of The Birth of Tragedy, a man named Wilamowitz Möhlendorf, was himself not pro-Jewish at all and was kind of anti-Semitic later on in his life. He became a very prominent classicist, but he was the person who wrote against Nietzsche, and he was then defamed by Nietzsche and his circle of friends as someone who was in the hands of a Jewish conspiracy in Berlin. These were the kinds of paranoid fantasies that Wagner harbored and that Nietzsche touched on at times, but of course wasn't invested in quite as much.
Well, Bob, we're running short on time, so I want to ask you another question.
Sure.
What would Nietzsche have made of National Socialism or the Nazis had he lived to be, 80 or 90?
That's a very difficult question to answer because I think that there that there's evidence in his writings and in his letters that he would have hated National Socialism because it was, after all, a movement of the masses. Nietzsche was against mass movements. He was against ultra-nationalism. You can certainly, and he was against this kind of crude anti-Semitism which the Nazis displayed. So there is evidence that he would have detested National Socialism. On the other hand, you can say that Nietzsche possibly could have seen Hitler as a reincarnation of Napoleon, someone that Nietzsche admired very much in the 19th century, someone who is taking control of the destiny of the German people and of Europe, and seeing him as a kind of a Superman, someone who was finally controlling German destiny in the way that it should be controlled, and someone who was an embodiment of the will to power. You can read things both ways. It's difficult to say what Nietzsche would have done unless he were in that position, and he never was in that position. So that's why I'm rather careful with this and try to describe Nietzsche in his own time and how he actually reacted to things in the 19th century. That's all we can really say. The rest is speculation. But you can look at other philosophers, someone like Martin Heidegger, for example, who did join in with National Socialism for at least a time, and you can say that possibly Nietzsche would have been seduced into doing so as well. It's hard to say.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bob, we've taken up a lot of your time, so any parting thoughts you'd like to share, and what are you working on next?
Well, I'm working on the original book that I had started on, and that's to place Nietzsche in his own time with these various social questions and scientific questions. I'm almost finished with that book. So, and one of the chapters will be Nietzsche and the Jewish Question, a kind of a shortened version of the book that we've been discussing. And I hope to have that finished over the summer. So that's where I'm at. I think this book will, the coming book will properly describe Nietzsche and his relationship to his own times.
Bob, that sounds like a great project. I want to thank you for being on the show today. The book is Nietzsche's Jewish Problem, Between Anti-Semitism and Anti-Judaism, published this year by Princeton University Press. The author is Robert Holub. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.